Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss brain imaging and modeling with scientists from around the world. Today, my guest is arguably one of the most influential scientists in the human brain mapping community, Dr. Peter Fox, director of the Research Imaging Institute at the University of Texas Health, San Antonio. Early in his career, he wrote the seminal paper that showed, using positron emission tomography, that brain activation-related increases in blood flow are accompanied by only small increases in oxidative metabolic rate, resulting in blood locally increasing in oxygenation. This paper set the foundation for understanding all of blood oxygen level dependent contrast, or BOLD, used in fMRI today. The true purpose of activation-related flow increases is still an open question. The story of the events and details surrounding this are in his review article from the 2012 NeuroImage Special Issue. His article is titled simply, "The Coupling Controversy." Peter was also among the first to promote data sharing and pooling with his brain map database, and early on established stereotactic coordinates and spatial normalization as ways to put data into shareable space. He started the annual meeting that predated the Organization for Human Brain Mapping meeting, and also founded one of the major brain mapping journals today, titled Human Brain Mapping. Peter had his formative undergraduate education at the extremely unique St. John's College in Annapolis. He received his MD from Georgetown University, interned at Duke University, then carried out his residency and fellowship at Washington University, where he worked closely with Dr. Mark Raichel, who was at the time pioneering PET scanning. In this discussion, we delve into his contributions and importantly, how everyone from neurovascular coupling to the challenge of spatial normalization, particularly at high resolution, to subject variability, to clinical applications, and the ongoing evolution of scientific publishing. Lots of history, content, and insight here. I hope you enjoy it. It's my honor to have Peter Fox on the podcast, and I've known Peter since the very beginning of my career. In fact, his paper, which we'll talk about, his number of papers were key, at least for me, in sort of making sense of the BOLD signal at the very start. And it touches upon many things that are related to neurovascular coupling, of course, that are still, I even read papers recently that are still talking about it and debating it today. And of course, most of you know Peter. He was one of the founders of OHBM, and he started BrainMap. He was one of the first people to begin data sharing and data pooling and a number of other things too. So this will be a lot of fun. So just to begin, I like to usually start off with history, how you got to where you are now. And more importantly, maybe what were some of the key experiences or mentors that you had that, or decisions that you made that helped you?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm pleased to be here and excited about the opportunity to share some of the history and things that helped me in my career, things that directed me. I'm from a family that has a lot of physicians in it going back generations and into the future. And so I decided really well before high school that this was clearly an enjoyable career, and everyone seemed pleased in their work. And being a physician is flexible enough that if you're not happy with your current job, it's always easy to get another job. There's just unbounded opportunities. But I was definitely interested in doing research in medicine, that I knew that. I wasn't sure in what organ system I wanted to work, but when I went to college, I spent a lot of time studying scientific theory, reading Descartes and reading Hobbes and trying to understand the foundations of science and what it means to be a scientist, and read a lot of Epistemology, so how it is we know what we know, what constitutes knowledge of the environment, just how do we experience the world. And there was clearly a development that to me kind of culminated with Kant arguing that our consciousness of the environment was fabricated, in that it comes to you as an unconnected manifold and you connect it according to rules that remain to be discovered. But I mean, Kant uses the term the manifold of perception, and that you become conscious by synthesizing that into objects. It's like, okay, that's very discoverable, because we know from neuroscience going back a century or more that different functions are in different areas of the brain, but we have a unified experience. And so we can study that ideally in people. And so that was definitely what I knew I wanted to do in college. And so when I went to medical school, I was looking to see really in neuroscience which path to take: neurology, neurosurgery, psychiatry, and kind of weighing the benefits of the different fields, and settled on neurology as having the greatest opportunities for exploration there. And began looking at what methods I wanted to use, and was looking at papers coming out of Denmark doing basically single photon imaging with carotid injections of radio tracers.
Yep, I remember those.
Yeah, and studying movement, but also studying speech and language, and clearly getting traction. And so I looked for where to do that in the United States. And the answer at that point was, well, really no place yet, but the place that's closest is Washington University and the lab that Terpagosian was putting together, and bringing in people, bringing in Mark Raichle, and creating the foundation to get aggressively into this area. And so, I mean, when I arrived, one experiment had been done like that. And they were happy with the experiment, but really the methods weren't ready for not just prime time, but just rigorous use. They needed to be refined. And so I went there, and that was what got me there, why I picked that place. And then the path of work, the output that you've seen from those early studies was really highly productive, period.
I think that was about the early 80s. I mean, how many PET scanners existed back then?
Oh, very few. I know there was a prototype at Harvard. The Terpagosian had built, and I saw it when I interviewed, he'd built a PET-3, which was really kind of a proof of principle machine. And then he was building the PET-6. And so I didn't see the PET-6 until I arrived. And so there was a period there while I was doing internship at Duke where there was no PET scanner. But by the time I arrived in residency in 80, PET 6 was being installed. And so that's what I got to work on, was the PET 6, which Terpagosian had designed and built. And so that was definitely the best machine available. It was designed really for oxygen 15, so it was a very fast scanner. And none of the image processing had been developed, but the image reconstruction was developed. So it was making images, digital data, but nobody'd really worked on how to analyze that data. And so that's kind of where I came into the scenario, trying to figure out what images I wanted to create, what data sets, and how did I want to analyze them.
And so it seems that I was reading also that you sort of in terms of analyzing one way of you have to put it, the data into some sort of standardized system, the stereotactic coordinate system, that it sort of was your thing, it seems, that you created that method of doing that, or one of the main people that pushed that. And obviously the subtraction and things like that too, that was all sort of being built from scratch.
Yeah, that was actually fun and interesting. I definitely didn't want to follow the path of like putting images up side by side and looking at them and interpreting them visually. Right. So the radiological approach seemed to me really inadequate to the quality of the data. And the images would all be in register. If we acquired them one after another in a session, we could get 10 or 12 scans in a person in a session in an hour and a half. And if we registered the head, and so we put on a thermoplastic mask to hold their head still, and they definitely stayed still in that. And so the images were intrinsically in register. And so the first thing was to start subtracting them. And once we could subtract them, I mean, you lost all the background, so there was no residual anatomy, but the contrast was spectacular. We were seeing 40 and 50% changes in blood flow. I mean, they're big. At the cellular level, they're more like 100%. They're massive changes, right? And so it's like, okay, so we have signal. We know that. And so then the question was, how do we most reliably record and report and compare between people? At that point, you could get a good study out of a single person, right? Still, we wanted to compare between people. We weren't thinking so much about averaging as comparing the responses between people and seeing the reliability of location. And so with that, I started looking at atlases and looked at the Shalton brand atlas and looked at different ones, but I saw references to the Tallarik atlas, but didn't have access to it. And so got access to it through a trip to Paris and bought it in a bookstore in Paris. Brought that. That was the 67 atlas. And so figured out how to register to that atlas. And so started registering images to that atlas and reporting coordinates in that space. Because Tallarik in that atlas had a lot of functional studies that he'd done, stimulation and recording, and had already defined functional areas and was reporting them himself, not in the tabular way that we do now, but pretty close. Right. And so putting data into XYZ coordinates and reporting them as tabular data, we started in 84. And so that's still the standard. As best I can tell, in all of neuroscience, that's the most widely adopted standard.
And right, because it had to start with something, and it seems to make very much sense, and it just works, and it's very simple and elegant and can be adaptable. So before we get more into this discussion, I just wanted to back up just for a second because I think it's really important. You went to St. John's, and I think that's unique. My kids are just starting to, I'm starting to look for colleges, and I looked at St. John's, and it's a really unique university. And I think that, could have been formative in terms of, forcing you to reflect on these things and then, sending you forward. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, St. John's is a really unique place, I thought.
So I agree with that completely. And there's one other aspect about St. John's that people need to be aware of. So there are no textbooks and no lectures, or really one lecture a week, Friday afternoon or Friday evening, and the whole campus goes, right? All the teachers go, everyone goes to the one lecture. It's always an invited lecture, usually by somebody outside. And right, so rather than lectures, we read. And there were no textbooks. We read original works. So when we did math, it was Euclid's Geometry, and you would read Euclid. And then the way the classes were run is you would volunteer to do a proof. And we went through Euclid's Elements proof by proof. And you did the proofs with no notes. And you said, this is the proof, and this is the proposition I'm proving, and this is the argument. And you would do it on the board. And that was the training. And so for physics, we did Newton's Principia, proving it the same way, exactly the same way. For every class, it was original reading. We read special relativity, that we read originals. We would have to write papers, basically a couple per semester for every class. And to go to the next year, you'd write an enabling essay. So we were reading and writing original works constantly. And to me, that was really very motivating in that there's, from my perspective, there's nothing out there that you can't read and understand, and there's no one you can't challenge. If you read something, so, in reading Roy and Sherrington, it's like, well, that's a theory, but they could just as well be wrong. So the notion of contradicting, a century-old dogma was not at all problematic. That seeing different philosophers arguing over the span of time, right? There's a really lovely poem that's called Lefar, that it's about beacon lights on hills, and that in Greece, if there was a battle, they would send messages by lighting beacon lights on hills. And it was comparing the scientific dialogue to beacon lights on hills, but spanning centuries instead of miles. And that this is the conversation we should be part of, and to not be intimidated about talking to somebody who wrote hundreds of years ago. So that is the conversation. So I think, the coupling controversy and all of that, it's like, yeah, we're arguing with Sherrington and we're trying to light a beacon on the hill and carry knowledge forward. And that is the way that it works.
There should be more of that, because I think actually a lot of even a lot of graduate students or postdocs or even scientists now, I mean, they come in sort of this feeling of, not really, this whole idea of looking at things from first principles or even looking in the deep history at theories and sort of arguing that it's more along the lines of trying to see how things fit in. That's everyone's, I see so many abstracts where people write them and they say, oh, well, this is in agreement with this and this and this. And they think, okay, we're done. It's like, well, all right, that's the good, but and it's nice to be in agreement, but at the same time, it's more interesting to challenge, push the forefront of knowledge in terms of either challenging assumptions or theories or things like that. And so, yeah, this is perfect. So as far as getting into this discussion of this paper, I mean, everyone thinks of Roy and Sherrington and, they think, oh, well, good. This is this predated, and then, looking at his papers, his, blood pressure traces are really look like fMRI responses and his theory that that people still believe today. And it's, there's still an ongoing discussion. The common knowledge, even in OHBM, is that, blood flow increases to satisfy, increase CMRO2 demand, and that's it. That's why. And obviously, and that's what started with Sherrington, and you challenged that. And so I think it's worthwhile talking about maybe that paper to begin with.
It was pretty interesting when I was writing bl the early papers just using blood flow responses. You always have to start, with the introductory paragraph, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And what are the assumptions, right? And so I read the papers coming out of Denmark and early papers by Per Roland and others, and they would just gloss it. They would just say, blood flow is related to neural activity, and that's just a fact, and move on. We had these techniques where we could actually test that. And it seemed to me that it would be much nicer to be able to write the introduction saying it's been proven that blood flow relates to neural activity by this mechanism. That was really the motivation, was to be able to have a better causal link as we're doing using these tools, and to motivate people to use them, to give them confidence in the tools. And so that the studies we did, it was a series of papers that looked at blood flow metabolism coupling. And I laid it out, I think, in some detail in that paper, The Coupling Controversy, which certainly we ought to encourage your listeners to pull that paper and read through it. That walks through the argument in a lot of detail. But we put a lot of thought into it, and we're very confident in the data, not as confident in what it meant, but the data were really quite solid. And I think the data have held up really remarkably well as people have struggled with coming up with interpretations, and some people trying to resolve Roy and Sherrington and their hypothesis. It's like, well, don't worry about the hypothesis, worry about the data. That's the data we're confident in, and what the interpretation is we can work on.
So I mean, when you brought this up, so basically, your I mean, the main paper was basically saying that, flow increases, CMRO2 only increases a little bit, so there's an uncoupling, and that's why, that explains, that's the paper that I know you worked with Ken Kwong and the MGH group in terms of, that sort of helped motivate that construct. I sort of got about it backwards. I was sort of a little bit behind them. I was getting, the data, and I'm like, oh, I was I, in an early paper by Ogawa. He sort of threw it out there before in 1990. He was like talking about Bolt. He's like, oh, well, it might predict show brain activation because the signal should go down. He wasn't even t thinking about flow increases. Wasn't reading that literature yet, but he read it quickly afterwards. But I was looking for signal decreases, and I kept on seeing signal increases. And I'm like, that's strange. Going in the literature, I couldn't find anything that would suggest that until I came across your PNAS paper that said, hey, oxygen extraction fraction actually goes down during activation. So BOLD had to go up. Oxidation had to go up. The more nuanced part of this, though, I think the reason why it was a controversy back then, you know, that was great for me. I just simply, all I had to say was oxygen went up, but was the linkage to CMRO2 versus CMR glucose. And there was, you know, and I never fully understood why, for instance, Louis Sokolov would, you know, I remember being there in some of those lectures where he would just get up and just, you know, really tried to punch holes in everything and have a hard time with it. And, you know, he was the inventor of FDG. Right now, even still reading that paper and reading his, I don't feel that it really threatened, you know, because, you know, he was looking at glucose as a marker. I don't know how that he felt that, I mean, I don't know whether he felt threatened or whatever, but I mean, I don't know how it disturbed his construct of how things would happen, because, you know, he's showing that glucose goes up. And so.
So, yes, I agree. Very clear that glucose went up and that oxygen metabolism didn't. But Sokolov and many others really were working with the assumption that it was all about ATP generation. And there was one paper which got published. I thought it was really comical. They converted all their values into ATP values, assuming, and this is a blood flow paper. And it's like, this, they published it all in terms of energetics. And I said, but all your assumptions are wrong. Why are you doing this? Can't you read that blood flow goes up, but it isn't about energetics. It's about something else that we don't understand yet. And I think Sokolov was of that same mindset, that he was assuming that the point of glucose was energetics. And if oxygen metabolism wasn't going up, then it wasn't oxidative phosphorylation and it wasn't about energetics. And that he thought that was what the interpretation should be. And that if it wasn't, that people would think that FTG wasn't as important as they thought, because energetics is what's really important. And it's not reflecting energetics. It's like, but it's reflecting neural activity.
I mean, there was later papers by Mintum, but you also, I remember, showed data that I thought was really compelling at the time, a long time ago. I don't know if you published this, is that you blocked the blood flow response and you still showed that, you know, activation still happened. Everything was fine. You know, you don't really need a blood flow response to keep things, you know, the metabolic rates high.
I think people's presumptions get in their way.
Yeah, just to illustrate how this is still, I mean, it's an important issue. I mean, it might be slightly esoteric to some people because they just worry about large vein effects or, you know, and neurovascular coupling is becoming more important now in terms of, you know, predicting stroke or things like that. But there's even a paper that I just saw, and I sort of laughed and was just amazed with that, by DiNuzzo. I don't know if you saw that one.
It's a lovely paper.
Yeah, and it detailed modeling, and actually my takeaway from that was that, you know, yes, for whatever mechanism blood flow increases related to neural activity, it's not to provide oxygen or glucose or anything. It's basically to just clear out the waste.
Yes, I think that's true. I think their paper is it agrees with a lot of data. Some of the earliest studies that I really focused on and studied a lot were from Elfrieda Leninger-Follert, who had really quite a lovely prep. It was bicuculine-induced seizures in a cat with an exposed cortex. And those are periodic bursts, right? And so firing goes up, and then it goes down, and then it goes up, and then it goes down. And so you get many, many, many periods of activity. And she had a prep where she was measuring PO2 and PCO2 and pH and blood flow with platinum electrodes, and was measuring all of this pretty much continuously. And it was very clear that the pH goes down and the PCO2 goes up very fast. And then the blood flow response kicks in, and then they normalize.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Over and over.
Yep.
Okay. That's clear that it isn't about lack of oxygen, that the fastest signal are the basically the waist signals, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And the blood flow response was right on the heels over and over. And so that to me was strong motivation for what we were doing and that it made a lot of sense. And I think, I mean, I cited those, but I don't think that sunk into people as much. But definitely the paper from Danuzzo is right on the money with that. That we wouldn't disagree with any data that I've seen. It really brings them all together.
Yes.
James Pritchard did a study based on ours in 91 with MR spectroscopy and said that there was a big lactate signal. It's like,
Yep.
yeah. And this is what's driving it. It's like,
Yes.
I think there were definitely people who were very much on the money that didn't get enough thought given to their experiments because many people were just still trying to rescue the metabolism story.
And yeah, it's interesting how theories, they have a life of their own. It's really hard to get a collective knowledge to move away from them, especially when they're established in 1890 or whatever. But it's interesting. The implications are, like for instance, even with things like vascular dementia or whatever, people always feel it's, oh, lack of oxygen to the brain, the brain starts, suffering. And it could just be a waste removal. And I think it still potentially ties into the lymphatic system potentially. And so, it could be a mechanism for dementia, for if you have bad poor flow or circulation. And it could be because of the waste removal, because all this waste starts accumulating, or the blood isn't the right pH or something like that. So yeah, and you did all these other studies too, where you did long-term effects. And I remember back when I was a postdoc at MGH, I talked with you about long-term effects. And I tortured people with, I think, your goggles and other things with, for more than 25 minutes of, showing flow and then BOLD staying up. And, as long as flow stayed up, BOLD stayed up. So, and so that was sort of, there was no, and as you would say back then, is that, even 10 seconds is sort of an infinity of time for brain activation. So, things happen pretty quickly and they pretty much stay stable.
I think that's really quite clear.
That was great. And it's unfortunate because those glass goggles are not sold anymore. I mean, there's probably better options, but it's nice having things that are goggles that are well timed and for those sort of experiments. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the field of brain mapping and your brain map database, but also the meeting that preceded the origination of OHBM. So I mean, I imagine both the brain map meeting and the brain map database sort of came on at the same time, maybe in the late 80s or something like that.
Yes, actually, as soon as we got averaging working in standard space, right? And so that was working pretty well, like in 87, and the papers were in review that you could average. And so that was pretty obvious that as you average people together, that even just in the 3D coordinate space, as crude as it was, that the signal to noise just went up perfectly as predicted, right? So although there's individual variability, there's not that much. And so averaging across people was huge. And that meant that we could go after things that were much more subtle than primary sensory and motor cortices. We could go after cognition, right? And so that was fundamental to me of being able to get at signals that might be much weaker. And so we did spend time looking at whether there's differences in individual variability as you go between primary areas and higher order areas in 3D space. And the answer was there's not. And reading, I spent a lot of time reading Brodmann and early papers looking at the relationship between cytoarchitectonic areas and gyri. And Brodmann was clear that outside of sensory and motor cortices, the gyri are poor predictors of cytoarchitectonic areas. Don't expect the gyri to hold up. And that was clear, right? And so to me, the notion of relying on sulcal landmarks has been known to be flawed for more than a decade. And now, can you register things by primary sensory gyri? Sure. Central sulcus is a good landmark, right? But beyond that are the other sulci good landmarks. It's like, well, Brodmann, who invented this, says no. So why try? But 3D space is quite robust, and we can show that it doesn't degrade as we go to higher and higher cortical functions.
Okay.
Right. It's like, okay, so this is what we've got to work with. Does this explain all variability? No. But to the degree that averaging works, it's explaining, it's showing that people are, to this level, highly standardized, right?
Okay.
Very similar. They're stereotypic down to a level of, you know, 5 millimeters or so. And so that, to me, made it clear that this was a way that we could compare between modalities, between populations, between laboratories. And so in 87, I wrote a grant saying, if we've got this standard and people adopt it, then we can share hugely across all these other barriers about the organization of the brain, and got that grant, and then got other grants. IBM funded the BrainMap database very early on. And then it moved over to NIH funding, but it's been funded continuously since 87. So the meetings in San Antonio were really to make people aware of that, to get input from the community, to encourage people to use this framework and to report in it as a community reporting standard in a way we could compare. And so I was trying to gather data and then share it out, right? And so that started really early. So the BrainMap meetings started in 92 and then ran through 99. And then we had the OHBM in 2000. And it's like, I can't do two meetings in the same year, like as organizers, like I'm organizing OHBM. And so we'll let the BrainMap meetings go. And I really looked at the OHBM meetings as a replacement for the BrainMap meetings, that we've created the community. People are starting to share data, that the methods can evolve much further. And so I think that the BrainMap meetings serve their purpose, really, of motivating OHBM.
I think it's a really interesting topic that, once again, I think could still be revisited. It has been a little bit of this idea of variability. And, mm-hmm. and you know, if you put something into a coordinate space, somehow it's less variable in a 3D coordinate space than relative to the gyral folding. And that seems to apply, I mean, I can imagine it applies for it seems like it almost would depend, though, on you know, it sort of implies that there's some randomness in the folding, but there's not really that much, there's some in certain places. But yeah, I can't imagine, for instance, the motor cortex being on, you know, the wrong bank of, you know, central sulcus or something like that. That wouldn't happen, you know, if the brain were somehow pushed forward or back. But so it's sort of linked to the gyral folding in some way, but it makes more sense in 3D. And so it still seems like I'm still trying to understand the principles by what causes variability along with gyral folding, and why is it more well behaved in 3D space?
For the primary sensory motor cells, right? You definitely improve, you lower the variability between people if you normalize to those sulci. You do. And the 3D space, if your central sulcus is more anterior or more posterior than the next person, their anterior bank might line up with your posterior bank, right? And so that would be a big confusion. And so that's kind of the straw man argument for using sulcal-based anatomy. But as soon as you get away from those primary cell side, the minor cell side are really quite variable. And so using anything other than the primary cell side doesn't improve your variability. It just doesn't. So, I mean, there could be hybrid spaces where you register everybody to their, you know, you register everybody's central sulcus and Calcarin and Heschel's gyrus and, you know, kind of force normalization, but that's a lot of work. And you're going to have to put asterisks on which stereotactic coordinate system you used, and did you use it with these tweaks or didn't you use it with these tweaks? And we know that it works real well, and that, you know, for subcortical structures, neurosurgeons use it to put lesions.
Yeah.
Right. So it's pretty precise. So I think, I mean, people are using surface unfolding, but really a huge shortcoming in the field, which we're working now to try and address, is the fact that even though when people do surface unfolding, right, they put it into a polar coordinate space, right?
Yeah.
But for I don't know what reason, they don't publish those coordinates. If all of the studies that have been done, say by the Enigma Consortium, where they've moved things into a surface space, were that they published the coordinates, the meta-analytic power would be massive, but they haven't done it. It's like, so what's going on? You're putting them into coordinates and you're analyzing them in a standard space, but you're publishing them just as numbered regions of interest. You're pooling all of that, you're losing all that resolution, and you're not publishing coordinates. What's going on? That to me just seems that they just fail to take the lesson that we put forward there. And many of the people working in surface space, starting with David Van Essen and Anders Dale and Marty Serino, there were a lot of people that came to the BrainMap meetings and were putting forward, giving talks. They were in, I mean, all those talks were invited. And so we were inviting them to come and share what they were doing and encouraging them to make a surface space, a standard surface space, which was hard because when you do the surface folding or unfolding, you get discontinuities that you have to correct. There's a lot of work there, which eventually got solved, particularly by Dale and Bruce Fischel in the late 90s. They had a working coordinate space, a polar coordinate space, but it was never promoted for adoption. They didn't like publish in that coordinate space. When I developed the 3D space, I started publishing in it to give people templates, publish like this. And then everybody did, right? And they didn't. And so nobody did. It's like, but that would be, I think, that would be a huge contribution. I mean, it's a little late now. They could have done it 20 years ago, but still, it might not be too late because there's a lot of work being done with the surface space, but it really needs to be published as coordinates to share it because a lot of that data won't, the primary data won't be shared.
I mean, it's interesting, the whole concept of variability and data sharing, and like you said, so coordinate space. So it seems like now, like today, there's more of an issue of, for instance, for analyzing resting state or whatever, they divide the brain into parcels, by standard atlases. So they warp to a standardized 3D space, and then they divide the brain into parcels. And people are finding more and more that there's some variability among individuals in parcel location or tortuosity or size or whatever. So that's an interesting source of study. And just like you said, like if you put it in polar space, at least you should have the coordinates so that you could actually understand, the transformations that are necessary to do that, so you can sort of keep track of the variability in some sense. But it seems now like back in Wash U, they're sort of pioneering this concept of deep sampling, like taking one subject and scanning them for 10 hours. And they're finding, when they compare subjects, there's other ways of normalizing that aren't necessarily based on gyral folding or 3D, but it's more like myelination. There's myelination landmarks or things like that that might help in terms of normalizing. And to me, that big paper that came out on BWAS, saying that you need 2,000 subjects to make any sort of statement about variant populations. I think a lot of that might be still due to the fact that everything's smeared out. That's interesting when you average that many, when you average subjects together. So we haven't figured out the correct normalization across subjects or the correct landmarks in some sense. It seems like that's still an ongoing science, basically.
Absolutely, it is. I had a student recently comment to me that, well, if you put things in a standard space, you're losing variability. It's like, no, you misunderstand. If you put things in a standard space, you can quantify what's common and what the residual variability is. Out of standard space, you can't quantify that. Then you're just studying people one by one, which I refer to as stamp collecting. That's not what we're doing with science. We're trying to find what's common. We want to assess how much variability we've accounted for, how much residual variability there is. And when we promote a new standard, we have to demonstrate that it improves, it lowers the residual variability, it captures more of what's common. People need to come at it with that standpoint, that frame of mind, rather than saying, no, the individual variability is what we want. It's like, no, it's what you want to remove. You want to quantify and remove.
No, I agree. I agree. Keeping the transformations is critical. I don't know, and I don't know the literature that well, but it seems like there should be a systematic study of thousands of subjects of characterizing the transformation or the variability and what the transformations are for anatomy, function, maybe myelination, you know, maybe vascular structure. It seems that just knowing, you know, there could be some spatial heterogeneity of the variability. Just knowing that and having a map of that would be interesting, I think. And
so the only way to do that brain-wise is with a 3D space, right? Because if you're doing surface, it's only cortex.
Right, exactly.
Everything. So you're going to have two different spaces. It's like, well, let's do it all in one space and then figure out what the cortical folding really contributes. Those are measurable. And we've done studies like that. Other people have as well. But still, you want to promote a standard that many people can work with and accommodate without having to go to these enormous lengths to normalize and publish their data.
Yes.
I think that's one thing about the 3D coordinates is that they're very democratic, that you see papers from all over the world and all kinds of subject populations. Actually, one thing that I think is worth discussing in that regard is kind of the direction we've been focused on with BrainMap progress lately, which is really trying to mine as much as possible the case control contrast literature. And that's becoming quite a large literature where people have taken X number of controls and Y number of people with a given disorder. Okay, so if you do that, you find, so if you take 100 people with Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment, and you take controls and you subtract them, you get very clear patterns, very clear patterns. And that this works for psychiatric disorders as well. And so you can make maps this way, pooling data from multiple labs and get together very large samples of subjects just with their coordinates doing this case control contrast.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's quite powerful. So we've recently added a voxel-based morphometry database. So we started with task activation. And so now we have a voxel-based morphometry database. And we have what I'm referring to as voxel-based physiology, which is any voxel-wise analysis, which is a case control contrast. And so the earliest papers on that came out in the early 90s using blood flow and FDG to compare between psychiatric disorders. The biggest signal is out of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but the other disorders clearly have anatomical signatures. And a fundamental question is what's causing them? And do the abnormalities cause the disease, or does the disease cause the abnormalities? My assessment is that these are at base psychiatric disorders are cognitive and behavioral disorders. And what we're seeing with voxel-based morphometry and physiology is basically the scars from overuse, brain damage due to these recurrent symptom-associated firing patterns that cause focal atrophy. So it's not that you have depression because you just happen to have atrophy in certain brain areas. It's like you have atrophy in certain brain areas because you have chronic recurring depression.
Yeah. Right?
And so how to address that and try and avoid these consequences, I think, is very important area of study. And so we're looking at this as a source biomarkers and using those data to then create templates and models to quantify resting state within those patterns specifically.
Yep.
Yeah, so that works. You asked, you know, how do we use resting state and move it into clinical domain? I say, okay, you can't really discover this from the resting state data unless you have massive amounts of data. A lot of noise, it's not a huge signal, but if you use the voxel-based morphometry and voxel-based physiology disease signal from case control contrasts, it gives you data sets with tens of thousands of people.
Yes. Yes. There's
a lot of people that have published in this. And so that gives you a template where to look.
So, right. I mean, there's still, I mean, so you think that, so you got this from this massive data set, you have these templates, and you know, there's always the worry, not only of, you know, variability of individual subjects that, you know, sure, as an average population would give this, but there's also variation of, and I think this is a sort of the blind spot in some sense of trying to come up with population characterizations is that there's so much heterogeneity within the clinical population that it's, you know, you might have depression for different reasons and it might not converge in the same area. So you have to have a really homogeneous, as homogeneous as possible population to sort of make these biomarkers work.
I'd say yes and no. With the atrophy as nodes in the network, right? You can make that model more rich or more sparse. You can focus only on the areas of very consistent atrophy, and the edges between them, you can assess the strength of those edges. And so what we're doing is we're bringing the most robust models and applying them to individuals and seeing, do we find resting state network abnormalities within this predefined network? And the network is, so we're basically doing out of sample assay. So the literature is the sample that we're using to define the model, and the individuals are the out of sample that we're using to test the replicability of the model. So those models fit real well.
That's cool.
So when you say, well, everybody's variable, it's like, well, if you constrain the way you're sampling data, then you bring the variability way down. If you're trying to probe through all the data and, you know, just get overwhelmed by the variability, it's like, yeah, you're going to get yourself lost. And so this is really trying to use this standard literature to pose a very mathematically and anatomically constrained hypothesis and then test that for biomarkers.
One other thing too, then. So once you have the biomarker, you know, of course, it could be used for maybe prediction of treatment, or it could be used for, you know, having areas for neuromodulation like TMS or something like that. So is that sort of the idea that you put people in, you find that they match this template, and then you then apply either therapy or put them in a pool of treatment that might improve things?
So the things that we're working with, I think you're very much on target with how the biomarkers would be applied. Okay, so one biomarker we developed was for treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that we used to target a neuromodulation trial, which worked. And so the idea that you can identify which pathways you're trying to modulate and how you might access them non-invasively with TMS is right. And that could also be used to identify targets for deep brain stimulation, because the networks include both cortical areas and deep areas. So neuromodulation targeting is definitely something that can be extracted from this type of analysis. Another one we've been working with, which has worked surprisingly well, is in multiple sclerosis, which, although most people think of it as a white matter disease, the literature is now strongly showing that the cognitive effects, the disability related to multiple sclerosis, is gray matter related, not white matter related. And that, yeah, white matter is a poor predictor of disability and gray matter loss is a strong predictor. And so we've made a model and published this of the atrophy patterns in multiple sclerosis and then built a network model based on that and assessed resting state per subject in individual people with MS versus controls. So it's diagnostic with an accuracy of just over 80%. But what we think is even more promising is to use it as an outcome variable in clinical trials for neuroprotective agents. There are new neuroprotective agents, which are gray matter targeted for multiple sclerosis. They're coming on the market now. If you're trying to assess their efficacy by cognitive scores, those are extremely variable.
Yeah.
But if cognitive scores relate to the information transfer among gray matter regions, then resting state it should be a very good index of that.
Yeah. It seems that also multimodal like measures like, you know, ongoing EEG or MEG responses or resting state MEG or EEG as well might, you know, also complement this to some degree. So I just wanted to back up just for one more second, because I know that, you know, with the whole putting things in stereotactic space and reporting coordinates, I mean, usually that, you know, the coordinates are either like center of masses of the areas or things like that. It seems that there's a different sort of problem that arises, you know, as you go to much higher resolution. So we're starting to do layer specific fMRI or even ocular dominance columns, or, you know, if you get very, very detailed, it seems that normalizing a brain is almost like, you know, normalizing handprints. I mean, there's five fingers, you can do it. You can sort of, you know, stretch and bend, but once it gets down to a certain level of detail, it turns into more like a fingerprint where you can't, I mean, there's more variability. It's like it still follows principles of organization, but there's how do you normalize ocular dominance columns? How do you, how do you even get your head around averaging across subjects? And then you have to average in some other dimension than just space, it seems. Have you thought about how to take this beyond just stereotactic mapping at the resolution that we typically do to going to much, much higher resolution? What would you do?
What would be the benefit? What's the necessary outcome of getting that level of resolution into a standard space? Like, how would you benefit from doing that? It seems to me it's not clear what the goal of doing that is.
Well, the goal, well, one is either if you wanted to average across subjects, for instance. I mean, there's, Jim Haxby has been struggling with things like hyperalignment. I mean, if you wanted to average layers across subjects, and you wanted to have a pretty good guideline of how to do that, it seems like we're going back to then the gyral patterns. Like, okay, this is where the motor cortex is. This is where the activation is. Let's just by hand go in and try to average the layers across subjects, which is really, it can't be done pretty much. And so I guess either that or like any of the other purposes of stereotactic is maybe there are morphings of like, for instance, one person's ocular dominance columns will be a different pattern depending on, with amblyopia, of course they have a different pattern, or maybe other types of columnar organization might be different across subjects, but not so much so that you could average, and understanding that transformation, if there is one, could be useful as far as understanding, the principles of how the brain is structured and organized. I mean, it seems that, yeah, I can imagine less of a use towards if you're just, reporting coordinates and but if whole studies are on, characterizing things like the, frequency or tortuosity, or, if layer effects happen in one area of V4, but not another area, how do you quantify that difference? How do you report it? So that's, once again, it's the same question of it's descriptive right now. We're like, no, well, layers are here, and we sort of, in a sort of kludgy way, we put that into models of feed forward feedback if they're on certain layers versus others. But it would be nice to, have a whole brain layer specific coordinate system in some sense that captures that and allows comparisons across subjects and putting into models. That's, I guess, the purpose. It just seems like a big challenge that you have to understand how random or how principled the organization of the brain is at that scale.
If I were in that situation, which I'm not, but I would look for a strategy of very local registration. And because if you can, the orientation of the ocular dominance columns and you can align them based on their physiology and then see does that predict the layer specificity and differences in the layers and then worry about putting it into a global coordinate space at some later point. And it might be that all of those will have a certain variability at a place where you'll find these ocular dominance columns and that you'll say, yes, they would fit in here with this level of resolution, but individual subjects we can't really correct that we're correcting for them by, the size of the column and there's too much variability there. And so it might be like a local space that's just the whole local space is more or less registered into a global space, but you're not trying to make a global space with that level of resolution because
Right,
you
right,
won't.
right. I think, yeah, I think you're on, I think you're right. I think that's sort of the nature of what a solution might look like. I'm trying to think about how to do that with layer resolution stuff. And
I saw an interesting piece of work lately that made an argument I hadn't heard before, but seems to me really important to explore. And that was that the cytoarchitecture organization and the morphological similarity, like of layer thickness, et cetera, is higher between connected areas than disconnected areas, and that
that's good.
regions preferentially connect to regions that are like them. And so it's like, oh, well, is the wiring pattern such that it's similar, and that's why the areas are similarly layered? It's because they're bussed together. And so can you use that to predict connectivity? And that's what the argument was, is that you can use that to predict connectivity, and then you can confirm it with tractography and with functional, that level of anatomy, and looking for spatial similarity between layering has a signature which could potentially be used to register areas in this more global sense of connectomics. I mean, the 3D coordinates is really a static map, right? It's not a connectome level. And so as you go to layer specific characterizations, that might be intrinsically giving us information about connectomics.
Interesting. I'll look up the literature on that. That's actually kind of cool.
I mean, that may be something to think about as you're working with these different areas, is to just take the layering as a pattern and look for pattern similarities at that level, like how thick the different layers are and then what they relate to. And if you're looking at maps that are going from, V2 to MT, and you're looking for the similarity and the patterning, that might be a signal as to whether it will be robustly connected or not connected. So,
We could talk more about that, but the journal, Human Brain Mapping, you started it. You're no longer, you passed off being editor in chief to Simon Eickhoff. You were the person who led that journal for many, many years. It'd be worthwhile maybe talking about, how it started, maybe some of the early controversies with, not really controversies, but the early growing years, jostling with NeuroImage as far as the relationship with OHBM and how it's evolving.
actually, and the journal came to be in an interesting way. So we were initially publishing in physiology journals, American Journal of Physiology and Cerebral Blood Flow Metabolism, which didn't carry much human work, and got pretty clear messages, not written, but face-to-face messages, that those journals were seeing a big influx of human brain mapping stuff. And that they were mostly working in animal models, and they didn't want their journal to be changed, and we needed to have some other place.
That's interesting. Okay.
Like, that's a clear message. As well, at the time we were starting, I mean, there wasn't a dedicated human brain mapping meeting. There was Society for Neuroscience, in which human brain mapping was not all that welcome a contributor. Magnetic resonance meetings, where this was shown early, and again, it's like, no, we're physicists. What are you bothering us with this stuff for?
That's fun, but not the serious MR physics thing.
So the brain map meetings in San Antonio were really a place to bring together leaders in the field to discuss not just the brain map database, but were there standards we needed to create? Were there data sharing standards? Were there spatial normalization standards? Were there algorithmic standards that we wanted to address as a group? And so the conversation turned right away to forming an organization. That was in the first meeting. People were like, this is fine, but this is small. And it's that was basically by invitation only. And I funded almost everybody that came. So I had ongoing grants to support it and community support. And it was really, trying to create a foundation we could all stand on and move forward. And so pretty quickly we knew we wanted to create OHBM. And it was right at that time that I wrote up a proposal to create the journal Human Brain Mapping. NeuroImage existed, but it was really focused on animal work. So I put that and took it to Wiley and said, there's nothing like this. And they said, absolutely, we want this journal. I took it to Wiley. Actually, I asked people which publisher they'd recommend, and a number of people said that Wiley was pretty straightforward to work with. And so I didn't shop it. I just took it to Wiley, and they immediately jumped on it. And so it was launched right away. And so many of the people that came to the brain map meetings, I said, I'm starting a journal. This is what it's for. Do you want to contribute? And there was just a big response. Yeah. So I was editor in chief for 30 years, and figured 30 years is enough.
You're right. It's one of these things, like other things you've done. It's like sort of laid the groundwork. Its role has grown, and it's really important of, for catalyzing, like you said, just a place where people can focus their papers. Even though you're no longer editor in chief, I'm sure you think about this a little bit. I mean, I struggle with this. If I'm starting, I'm sort of part of the beginnings of like an OHBM journal that we're trying to focus on other objects and, called Aperture Neuro. And it seems that the landscape, I mean, is a tricky landscape that we're navigating. Everyone wants open access, but also everyone wants low cost open access. They're kind of at a tension. I mean, right now, Aperture Neuro has the very minimal of like, something like $1,000 or something, which is for many platforms that are bigger, it's lower than what the costs are. And so it's a tricky balance. And how is this going to go? I mean, is there going to be a completely different paradigm in publishing? And, just everyone's going to throw their papers onto a bioarchive like mathematicians have been doing for years. Or, what do you do?
I don't know if I have the best answer for that. I certainly, for a long time, OHBM, or excuse me, Human Brain Mapping was a subscription-based journal, which is all driven by library subscriptions, not individual subscriptions. The library subscriptions are where the money comes from. That means that it's very low cost to publish, but very limited access only to places that have libraries that have enough money to provide a subscription for the journal. So that's awkward for a lot of people. The open access is better, but it's not that perfect a solution because many places will let you view it online but not download a PDF, and they consider that sufficient open access. I think that's pretty cheesy. I personally am not a fan of the bioarchive style. I might see the purpose to some degree, but not that much. And the tendency toward open peer review to me just doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, the NIH style of reviewing, they maintain confidentiality very rigorously. Why? Because you get more fair and unbiased review. And definitely, I've seen in personal experience that if people know who the reviewers are and there's a negative review, they'll hold vendettas for decades, right? And so, if you put it forward like in bioarchive and it's a public review, you're just going to get softball reviews. You're not going to get people wanting to get pissed off at each other, right? And so, it's just, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. So, that's not really rigorous peer review. And so, I think the open review movement is fundamentally misguided. I think that that's just a bad idea.
Yeah,
So,
I totally agree with you. People like to do it. I give them an option, but I prefer anonymous protects everyone. And it, like you said, it makes for a good review. It better, people don't pull their punches as much.
I don't know how to get it so that everybody gets everything they want. I want everybody to have access. I want it to be reviewed quickly. I want it to be minimally costful. It's like, come on, just put the cost in your grants, right?
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, I think that for a lot of people that they can afford that, and you can always make exceptions for people who can't. And so yeah, it'll work its way forward, and hopefully we'll have that right optimal point between, review, openness, and accessibility, and also cost. But I don't know. It's a complicated multidimensional space. It's hard to. So okay, so just with the last few minutes here, just wanted to talk. We talked a lot about this as well, like as far as the what your thoughts on what most excites you about neuroimaging today, where you think it's going, what's the real potential for clinical impact? I mean, how actually will it be implemented in on a scanner, or I'm assuming it's MRI for the most part. And yeah, if you have any advice as well for people going forward.
In terms of advice going forward, I train a lot of students. I run a graduate program. I have a training grant. So I interact with trainees really quite a lot. And what I find most helpful for them, and this makes some of them very nervous, but even so, is that they really need to be thinking from the very beginning a 5 and 10 year trajectory of where they want to be and do a critical assessment of how to make that happen and what skills they have and what their strengths are and be unabashed about saying them. These are my strengths. I write well, or I know this. I'm very good at chemistry, but I don't know this. What are they? right? What cards do you have and which do you need to get to your trajectory? And then figure out how you're going to get them. And you don't have to get them all at once. You can get them over time, but you need to make sure that as you move through your training, that you're going to places that get you the skills you need. And you can't ask people for that, and you don't want to do it in a haphazard way. You want to have a plan and take specific steps to achieve that plan. And if you don't know enough, then you get mentors to help you talk through and create a plan. And the students that do that have really great career trajectories. And the ones that don't, that leave things more to chance, tend not. They tend to do not really move up through the ranks. And so I think that the earlier you can tell me that, why do you want to do neuroscience? Which patient populations are you interested in? What kind of career do you see yourself? What things are you good at and not good at? Do you want to get better at them or do you want to avoid them? It's like, let's get that kind of trajectory. And doing that really helps careers. Not being shy about going, like if it's moving, then move to go to a place that has the resources that you need to get trained. And so I think that the plan, the long range plan, starting in day one. And so when I talk to people, it's like, well, where do you want to be when you're done with medical school and you're done with your PhD and you're done with your residency? Where do you want to be? Because that'll determine everything we do together.
And it seems that's occurring more, and I think that's wonderful. That's really good advice. I mean, because I think a lot of people are in the short term, sort of like, the next thing, and they try to hedge their bets to not have to decide, and they're sort of because it, of course, you always have incomplete information, even in terms of what you might want, but you have to do something. Yeah, like you said, you have to sort of think through that as much as possible. That's great advice. It really people with the direction move much better through the world.
You and I have lots of contacts, right? So if somebody tells me they really want to do such and such, it's like, okay, well, I know the best place to do that is here. It's Stanford or it's WashU or it's here. And I'll call people up and I'll make contacts and I'll help you get there. But you need to know what you want, and then I can bring resources to leverage that.
Exactly. I think, and yeah, I think it's hard. It's uncomfortable to think about these things. So as far as reaching forward also, just yeah, any thoughts on well, fMRI, I mean, I always look at fMRIs or even neuroimaging in general as having these two goals, one figuring out the brain, and then the other one is having more clinical traction. How far do you think either can go?
So, I've been working a lot with resting state and will continue to do that. And the main motivation for me there is that task activation, I think, is too difficult to work clinically, other than for things like preoperative mapping, right? It's too much work, it's too demanding. So, that won't really do that. And that the static images, structural images, are okay, but the physicists can sort that out. They don't need a lot of help to make DTI better. That will just happen. But for the connectomics to really get at functional connectivity and use it as a state marker of diseases, I think has a lot of possibility, particularly because you're working with a dynamic acquisition. You can get a time series in a reasonable amount of time in an individual. And so you can measure functional connectivity, right? So you can get in there. And so what we need to do, I think, is to build models that can mine that. And that kind of second by second, you can get a whole series of images in the same person. And that there are statistical modeling techniques which are quite good. We spend a lot of time with structural equation modeling and with pairwise Markov random field modeling, that there are different mathematical structures that are pretty robust and do very well with a data set with 200 or 300 time points from an individual. They're very robust markers. And so I think that approach, not so much graph theory, I don't think the topology helps. I think it needs to be as numerical as possible. And resting state has that potential. And that's really where I see if we're going to move it into clinic, that's where I see it moving into clinic, is as an output, which is a quantitative output of a specific set of regions and their interaction that comes out as a report, basically, as a tabular report. I mean, if you get a cardiac MR, right, they measure stroke volume and they measure sphericity and they measure all of these things, and it comes out numerical.
Right.
The radiologist isn't there looking at your heartbeat, right? He's
Yeah.
looking at the tabular data.
Yes.
Yeah, so we want resting state to be moved into that domain where you're assessing the brain, and maybe it needs a challenge, maybe it needs hypercapnia, right, to flex its muscles, but still the output's got to be a quantitative tabular output.
Yeah. So all the processing steps need to be standardized and sort of packaged behind the And yeah, that's I totally agree with you as far as that's concerned. No radiologist is going to try to work with and interpret images as far as that's concerned. And I think that's possible.
And I think there are some things. I mean, we've done some work, not in huge samples, but a little bit different paradigm, where we've done independent components analysis of resting state and comparing them to standard norms about size per component. And in certain populations, that's diagnostic at the per subject level. That just definitely works.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I think that approach in disorders of consciousness, in predicting outcome from coma, that something as simple as that, as quantifying independent components from the resting state, that, I mean, if you have a basal ganglia infarction, which is not yet evident on structural images, it's evident on resting state. So I think there's things like that. We need to think about problems and taking advantage of the time series aspect. None of the other imaging modalities have that, right? So
Yeah.
you're getting out this dynamic time series. It's spatially precise. And so what do we do with that? And
Yeah.
so that's where I see it. And I don't think we're that far away yet. I think there'll be commercialization, marketing, stuff like that to get it into the marketplace. But I don't think in terms of the math, we're very far away.
I would agree. I would agree. And it also seems like things like even, epilepsy or, you might more easily. I mean, this has been going on for 20 years where people are trying to use resting state to localize the sources and for certain types of epilepsy and that, and there's many things like that, right? Where I agree. I agree. I mean, some might argue that maybe not pure resting state, like you're saying, maybe looking at a watching a movie or something that kind of takes your brain through some paces, but that it's not a task, could be more of a litmus test to pull people apart. But the general concept of, having that diagnostic quality and yeah, I totally agree. And having that tool at least there, so clinicians can try it and use it and work with it, I think was another problem that needs to be solved. I mean, just putting it out there before, sort of to grow the applications as opposed to having an application, put it there, I think somehow that needs to we need to get our foot in the door as far as that's concerned.
Yes.
But anyway, this is great. I could talk for many more hours, but I think that we covered a lot of ground here, and I think that everyone should be able to get something useful out of this, and it's, if anything, it's a perspective builder. So many things that are still relevant that were started 30, 40 years ago that are ongoing, the same types of problems that just changed their appearance a little bit. So thank you very much, Peter. And I hope this, are you going to the OHBM meeting or all right. Well, I'll see you there. I'll see you there.
Even soul.
All right. All right. Sounds good. Thanks.
Neurosalience is brought to you by Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode is produced by Stefania Asimopoulos and Ömer Faruk Gülban.